Darling, you've got to let me know. Should I stay or should I go? If you say that you are mine, I'll be here till the end of time. So you've got to let me know. Should I stay or should I go? It's always tease, tease, tease. You're happy when I'm on my knees. One day it's fine and next it's black. So if you want me off your back, well come on and let me know. Should I stay or should I go? Should I stay or should I go now? Should I stay or should I go now? If I go, there will be trouble.
Hello everyone.
Good morning.
Welcome back for another episode of
The Deciding Mind. This is Shelley Menalasino.
And Mitchell Belgian.
So we're going to present an interview today by Bruce, that we did actually, of Bruce McEwen, who we met down at the Society for Neuroscience. He moderated a panel for the press. The panel was on early life experiences. So Bruce McEwen has studied for decades stress. And he was one of the first to talk in the 60s and 70s about actually things like poverty, the impact of poverty and class and unemployment, those sorts of things, and the impact on the kind of stress that those things caused and how it led to cardiovascular disease.
So it was actually a very interesting panel, as usual, and way above our heads, as usual. But it was very—it wasn't really above our heads. But it was very interesting, small arenas of study that all add up to this picture. And Bruce McEwen is known for a lot of research, right?
Yes, and we did a general interview, and in this interview, he actually refers a bit back to some of the science that got presented. So we're going to play the interview and break it up a bit and then fill in the gaps and tell you all a little bit about some of the research that some of the young scientists that he had present on the panel.
Okay, so we're going to get started, and here we go. This is Mitchell Belgian.
And Shelley Menalasino.
For The Deciding Mind, we're here with Dr. Bruce McEwen. Has a long career of documenting neurophysiological and brain changes from stress in early life. Why don't you tell us how you'd summarize your work?
Also, it would not only stress in early life, but stress throughout life. And I think the underlying theme of what we are doing and what we have done is that the brain is a plastic and resilient organ, that the brain communicates in a reciprocal fashion with the rest of the body through the neuroendocrine axis, cortisol, the autonomic nervous system, hormones of all kinds, metabolic hormones, sex hormones, that it controls their secretion. It also responds to their actions. These hormones get into the brain, and one of the things they do is to alter not only the neurochemistry of the brain, but also the structure of the brain, the architecture of the brain, so that stress and an acute stress produces an adaptive response by the body, which is intended to help the body survive and maintain homeostasis and stay alive.
So give us an example of an acute stress.
Well, something that we wouldn't even call stress is getting out of bed in the morning, or some people would call that stressful.
I call that stressful.
Depends on the day.
I call it, oh shit, is another day sometimes. But and then your autonomic nervous, your blood pressure helps you, you know, get up and get going. Meanwhile, your circadian clock has elevated your cortisol, which makes you hungry for your morning meal, which gets your cognitive systems going, because cortisol is a good guy, not just a bad guy. And all the things that are designed to do is to actually help you function optimally. This is true in when there's you go to work, there's an increased workload. For example, there's a famous study of air controllers. The take charge guys were the ones who had low cortisol. And when something happened, they had to deal with a bunch of planes. Their cortisol levels went up. When that load was over, they went back down. This is also true of Robert Sapolsky's
So that's a healthy response.
It's a healthy response.
Right.
You got to turn it on and then shut it off. Mm-hmm. If the unhappy air controllers in the same study had high basal levels, that's not good. When they had a demand, it didn't go up that much. And when the demand was over, it didn't go down back down. That's an unhealthy response.
That's actually very similar to cardiac evaluation.
Exactly. And we know from work that we've done and over the years, one of the systems that is benefited by that very efficient elevation of cortisol is the immune system. We normally think of cortisol as suppressing inflammation, et cetera, which it does. But acute cortisol actually enhances immune system function by promoting the movement of immune cells to the place where they have to defend against a pathogen or repair a wound. And that makes perfect sense. And the same thing is true of that acute surge of cortisol in terms of enhancing aspects of memory. This is a dangerous place. I should remember it next time. Or more recently, we and others have found that acute rise of cortisol, if it prevents the development of PTSD. If you don't have enough cortisol at that time, you may develop PTSD down the road. So this is the good guy aspect of it, along with this facilitation of plasticity that I mentioned earlier, the idea that cortisol is dynamic hormone that helps the body and the brain adapt. But then when these systems are either not turned on adequately or not turned off, then other systems get out of whack. There's more inflammation, for example, if you don't have enough cortisol, and inflammation does all sorts of things. And if you have too much cortisol, as in the extremes of metabolic syndrome or Cushing syndrome, but even just under normal repeated chronic stressors, or sleep deprivation causes the diurnal rhythm to flatten. And so at the nighttime, when your cortisol should be coming down, it stays up and it programs the liver to make more fat, to put more fat on your body, among other things. So we have to consider the circadian variation and disruption of circadian functions by shift work, by jet lag, by all these things that we do. And that contributes then to the negative aspects of stress and glucocorticoids and inflammation, which has led us to talk about this concept called allostatic load. The idea of allostasis describes that acute adaptive response. That's what keeps us alive, turning on, turning off. Allostatic load is the price that the body pays for doing that, especially if there's a lot of stress, one after the other, or if there's this inefficient regulation of these responses. They don't get turned on or they don't get turned off, and these other mediators like inflammation kind of get out of control. I mean, we need a sort of harmonious balance of all of these mediators to function optimally and to age in the most, parsimonious, slowest way.
Bruce McEwen's book, I just want to mention to the audience.
This is us again.
Yeah, here we are live. It's called The End of Stress as We Know It. It's a small little book. And in the book, he really introduces this topic of allostasis and allostatic load.
That's different than homeostasis.
Yes,
right?
In order to stay the same, we must adapt. And that's the process of allostasis.
As opposed to homeostasis, where you're at a steady state.
Yes, it's actually we must be adaptive, right? A crisis comes along and we have to make changes. And he's going to go on into this next section here, talking about what happens when people had in their childhood early trauma. Huh. And that basically they react differently to stress. And so their response to stress, they have a larger allostatic load, is what he's going to go on to say. And I think it's very important, and some of the research, it sort of makes sense. But you put people in a even in an MRI scanner, if they've had and you stress them out by having them do a little math problem, if they've had early childhood trauma, they overreact to that kind of stress. Their blood pressure goes up, their heart rate goes up way more. You can sort of even blindly see the differences in two groups, one with early childhood trauma and one without it.
So does that have something to do with that as you're a child, you have less capacity to respond to untoward events? Is it a idea that you learn how to adapt to the world as you're growing up? And as a child, if you have something that happens that's just too far out of the ordinary, it just throws their...
Yes, I think that's one way to look at it. That it's out of their means, but also they don't know how to resolve what happened, right? Mm-hmm. Especially if it's repeated trauma, it doesn't sort of fade. Those kind of memories don't fade like other kind of memories.
So this concept that if you're a child and encounter trauma is very different for the first time. It's very different than as an adult if you encounter trauma for the first time.
Well, we've always known that. Adults with childhood histories are more at risk in their adulthood when they're faced with another trauma. You know, that one trauma, you're going to re-experience at some level all other traumas. But now we're sort of seeing at a physiological level why it is. But, you know, what you're asking is interesting. The other thing, if you look at these people in an MRI scanner, they also, the ones with histories of childhood trauma, they are hypervigilant, right? And so they're the parts of their brain that are connecting the brain and the body, they sort of overconnect, and it makes them overreact to things. And that's probably why the blood pressure is going up and the heart rate's going up. They're keyed up for what's gone wrong. They need to be vigilant.
Hypervigilance. This is the time when you're a child, you're actually forming networks in your brain, right?
And these those networks
can get laid down permanently.
Exactly. So here you are in an MRI. You have to do a math problem. You're being timed, and you over worry about what's going on.
I always think of networks like on Saturday Night Live with I forgot her name, but she kept plugging in the receiving board. I forgot her name. All right, I can't remember, but you got to plug in the cord to the right panel.
And
anyway, all right, we're going to go on. Here we go.
Back to Bruce McEwen.
Here we go.
So I wonder if you could take us through the early childhood trauma, because
sure.
That's today really what
right.
got presented. And
right.
And
right. Okay, so let's look back then at the things that some of which we heard today. When there is poor attachment, when a child is growing up in a home where their parents are distracted, where there may be a single parent who's trying their best.
Or a depressed mother.
Or depressed mother.
Depressed father.
Depressed father, alcoholic, substance abuse, siblings who are out of control. I mean... And if you add on, and that this could be anywhere, it isn't necessarily in poverty. And then you may add the quality of the neighborhood, danger, noise, pollution, and so on, which adds further factors. When you look at this, and this has been looked at in the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study based in California in the Kaiser Permanente Health, so it's middle-class population.
Was that a large study?
It was a fairly large study.
I imagine.
Yeah, you'll hear more about it this afternoon with Felitti and others. It's also been studied in Dunedin by Avshalom Caspi and Terry Moffat and colleagues. And it's also been studied in rural New York State by Gary Evans at Cornell University.
They've all studied adverse childhood events and the outcome, how it impacts health and mental health.
Exactly. And so how it impacts physical and mental health. And the maybe not so surprising message is that early adversity leads to increased levels of substance abuse, sexual precocity, later depression, and anxiety disorders and a whole host of disorders. What's less appreciated is that it also leads to increased incidence of cardiovascular disease, obesity, diabetes, arthritis, diseases of modern life, in part because a consistent finding is that this early adversity leads to increased levels of inflammation. And we mentioned inflammation a number of times. That seems to be, when that's elevated, of course, it accelerates, helps to accelerate the pathophysiology of many of these diseases, so including depression.
So the inflammation then increases the amygdala? I saw that. And then if the amygdala is overactive, it sort of cuts the what's the connection here?
Okay.
Because the first person spoke today about learning, right?
The first thing would be that an overactive amygdala and an underactive prefrontal cortex.
So the amygdala is...
The amygdala is the organ for fear and anxiety.
And it's a primitive, instinctual...
It's a primitive, right. It, when
brain
we
reason.
Are out walking in the woods and our peripheral eye sees what looks like a snake, we stop. We, even though it may not be a snake, but it's a protective mechanism. And this same brain structure has been used, is used now, to support our ability to learn to be fearful of things, but also many people think it supports positive emotions. Whenever you experience strong emotions, positive or negative, the amygdala is involved, and that's why some of those memories last longer than other memories, because they have strong emotional tone.
So when it gets triggered, it reinforces neural circuits in a very strong way.
That leads to these memories, right?
Okay.
Now, normally the amygdala is kept under control by the prefrontal cortex.
As we grow up,
one of the reasons that males have higher auto insurance rates is their prefrontal cortex grows more slowly, and in some males it never grows adequately, But it is sort of the regulator. Well, it controls self-regulatory behavior. So impulsivity, mood regulation, the nice little description that Eric Pakulik gave of how the interventions enhance not attention, but also it really self-control. He was talking about helping the prefrontal cortex grow and do its job.
Because those kids were having attention trouble. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. But that would be only the tip of the iceberg. They were probably having also other problems controlling their impulses to, you know, grab some...
Dysregulation of everything.
And maybe more likelihood of substance abuse and things like that. So if we can actually help that prefrontal cortex grow, it will keep the amygdala under control. And we know from a study by this lady in Canada, Sonia Lupien, that kids of depressed mothers have a larger amygdala. We know this is true from studies of kids who are in foster homes, but also in orphanages and things like that. They have a larger amygdala. The good news is a study from the Harvard Mind-Body Center that if you take somebody who has a chronic anxiety disorder, and this may have had its origins in early life experiences, and you successfully use a mindfulness-based stress reduction program, which would be another kind of intervention that's becoming more popular, if it's successful in reducing anxiety, it reduces the volume of the amygdala.
And this is in adults?
Yes, this is in adults. So There's hope that these kind of things, when they're, you know, as they are better developed, will actually help to change the brain. And you don't necessarily need a drug. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the thing I sort of mentioned at the end, and Regina mentioned too, the idea of reversing the lazy eye or helping someone recover from stroke. Well,
we are going to tell you about that in a minute. You know, I realize that probably many people don't know what we're talking about when we talk about amygdala, prefrontal cortex. And if you didn't learn it in high school, that's because these are actually recent, not discoveries, but
the relationships are sort of certainly been much more clarified
in the last 15 years. There's a great app if you want to get it.
Yes, Mitch
I have it in my phone. It's called 3D Brain. It's kind of cool. You can turn the head round and round and round, and it shows all of the aspects of these regions of the brain that we're talking about. You can download.
You know what's interesting, though? So you can, on that app, see where the amygdala is, and you can see, of course, which is deep in the brain, and you can see where the prefrontal cortex, which is, of course, behind your forehead. But even on those apps, you're not going to see the relationship, the actual, like we were talking about earlier, the networks.
Right.
So it's...
They had a recent exhibit at the Museum of Natural History where they showed all the circuits of the brain that they've been able to analyze. But those circuits are deceiving, aren't they? Because there's millions and millions of these circuits that are laid down between different regions of the brain. But how they actually fire and why.
Right, because there are millions of neurons, but there are on each neuron thousands of synapses. So that's where you get into the very complicated network.
Synapses are the space between nerve axons and dendrites.
Right. It's nerves that are wired together fire together. Right. It's basically that concept.
Still didn't remember the Saturday Night Live. Someone's better email me, please.
You know, so what Dr. McEwen was talking about there is actually an 8-week study that was done of adding special attention training for kids and actually helping kids, because attention obviously is important in school, and in order for a kid to have do well, they have to be able to sustain selective attention. So this is not referring to attention.
You mean pay attention to the teacher?
Yes, but actually be able to pay attention only to that and not to everything that else is going on.
You can't throw paper airplanes at everybody else.
Right. The ability to have a spotlight in your own brain, basically. And they now have an 8-week course that they can teach kids on really improving their ability to have selective attention.
That was called Brain Camp, right?
No, the Brain Camp was actually for residents, psychiatric doctors.
I see.
But at the same time, what they did with the parents is they trained the parents about how to use language and how to lower what's called expressed emotion, because if they use overly emotional language, it actually interferes with the kid's ability to pay attention. So that combination of teaching kids to improve their selective attention and teaching parents to dampen down expressed emotion.
So the amygdala is the scream and shout organ.
Yes, exactly.
And the prefrontal cortex is the shut up organ.
Well, the amygdala, if it is overreactive, it doesn't allow the brain to be able to...
So it's like when guys are immediately going to have a fight. That's their amygdala saying to respond immediately to an emotional situation. And then mature, the prefrontal cortex will say, look, wait, slow down. This isn't what you really want
to
do.
I don't have to say this right now. I don't have to be impulsive. There's another way I can deal with this. Right.
Mm-hmm. All right. So we're
going to go back to Bruce McEwen,
okay.
Yes.
All right. We're going back. Lazy eye. He's going to explain to us what lazy eye represents. Okay, here we go.
One of the classic problems or critical periods in brain development is the development of a vision
pathway.
Yeah, with both eyes, binocular vision. And the visual cortex is organized then with the eyes and their crossing and so on to see things in two-dimensionally with or three-dimensionally with the both eyes. But if one eye is closed, then monocular vision develops and that other eye is useless. That's sometimes called lazy eye. And this is not it happens in humans and it's done experimentally in animals. Well, this group in Italy, I don't know how they got the bright idea of doing it, but they took animals that had this monocular vision because if one eye was closed. They subjected them, they gave them visual stimulation of both eyes, and they first gave them Prozac. Now, the reason that Prozac may work on depression is that it increases the production of some of the neurotropic factors like BDNF.
Program called Lyme in person. She pulls
neurotropic factor.
Fertilizer, basically.
It's a plasticity inducer. It's one of the things that helps the brain change its synaptic connections and grow or shrink dendrites and make new neurons in the hippocampus. And lo and behold, the Prozac accelerated recovery of binocularity. They then came back later and said, well, we can do the same thing by giving animals food every other day. So it was partial caloric, it was caloric restriction. And one of the things caloric restriction does is elevate glucocorticoids.
Fasting, so, basically.
Fasting
eating,
every other day.
Okay.
Yeah. So then they came back and they gave cortisol, corticosterone in the rat, in the drinking water every other day instead of caloric restriction. And lo and behold, it did the same thing. And we now know.
So that last, what's happening in that last group there?
Well, it shows that it's the cortisol elevation by the caloric restriction that is sufficient to do this. Now, what do we know about cortisol? There's a former student of ours who's now on his own named Connor Liston, who teamed with an investigator at New York University who can look at the living cerebral cortex of an animal through a thin skull preparation. So they can actually see individual spine synapses on these neurons. And they can record them over time, and they can see spines forming or disappearing. And the spines have a way there's dynamic turnover.
You want these spines, right?
These are where synapses are made. Now, this may not be all the connections, but it's some of the connections to these neurons in the cortex are coming and going. They're being formed and replaced. What he did, and he saw this dynamic turnover, he then gave a tiny dose of dexamethasone, which is a glucocorticoid, but uniquely at low doses, it doesn't get into the brain. It's pumped out of the brain, but it gets to the pituitary gland, and it shuts off ACTH secretion. So essentially, you're depriving the animal of its own glucocorticoid. And he found that this turnover of these spines stopped. And then he gave back glucocorticoids and found that he could restore that turnover of spines. So the pulsatile secretion of ACTH and cortisol that goes on in all of us around the clock is very likely to be facilitating this dynamic turnover of spines in the brain. And you can add on a few other things, but it certainly suggests the hypothesis at this point that the ability of this glucocorticoids to help reorganize the visual cortex is part of how this dynamic, facilitating this dynamic process, and to bring BDNF in the picture, there's a study again. This plasticity inducer. There's a study that shows that one thing that cortisol does is to increase the activity, the sensitivity of the receptor for BDNF, for fertilizer. So that whatever BDNF is being produced in the brain is actually being amplified by the ability of cortisol to increase the activity of the receptors. And this may be the reason why this plasticity is taking place, is that it's enhancing this whole process.
Huh. So normally you have pulses of cortisol. In the morning it's high, it goes down at night.
The overall envelope under the curve is that before you wake up in the morning, your circadian clock has elevated. And that's what wakes you up, makes you more active, gets you hungry for your morning breakfast, and so on. But even those things are pulses. It's like this. And the envelope under the curve is there's a diurnal elevation, and then it goes down, goes up around lunchtime, goes down further, and in the evening it should be very low until early in the morning, when it goes up again with the circadian clock that caused. And if it does not show, as I said before, if it does not go down in the evening, the clock, the genes in the liver are sensitive. They can be reprogrammed by the cortisol. They're clock genes, and they are connected to genes, enzymes that make fat out of carbohydrates, out of fat, of proteins. And they will enhance obesity. And one study that we did was actually to put mice into a 10-10 light-dark cycle.
What's that?
A 10-hour light, 10-hour dark, whereas normally we're 12 and 12. Our biological clock is primed to 25 hours, and it can be synchronized to things that are close to that. but 10 hours light, 10 hours dark, it can't adjust to. So what happens is that the animal free runs, that you can measure body temperature, that just free runs. It has no base, no bearing on the light and the dark periods. It's sort of like people doing shift work. And it also may be reminiscent of people who are sleep deprived, who are jet lagged, and so on. And what we found is that over a month to 2 months, these animals became fatter. And they became both insulin and leptin resistant, which indicates, you know, they're developing the metabolic syndrome. And the neurons...
Just by changing the sleep
wake. Yeah, and we know shift work tends to do the same thing. And it also caused neurons in the prefrontal cortex to shrink, and the animal became more cognitively rigid, was less able to shift from one task to the other.
I'm trying to paraphrase this for our audience. So in the concept of what you're saying that basically we have a rhythm that that's a cycle of how we respond to cortisol in the morning. We have appropriate responses during the day when we encounter stress and at night. But even within that cycle, there's a rhythmic pattern of the cortisol within that cycle. And that rhythm is very important for proper activity.
Proper plasticity. Right.
So our body is normally adaptive, and that is plasticity. If we are within these normal patterns of our life, we are able to respond appropriately to stimuli and to our lives, and we are able to stay healthy. But alterations such as poverty, cycle work at night, have these effects on our health that you can now basically determine through
hormones and brain circuits.
And imaging methodologies.
Right, right. And what it also points out to us, as if we didn't already realize, is that our modern life is really pushing us away from the direction that Mother Nature intended, that leads to the most optimal function. And what we have to do as individuals is to try to, you know, normalize that as much as possible,
We're exposed to constant stress all day long.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
And the people who have jobs who are always on, their phones can ring at any moment. They must develop these poor cycle responses.
There's a study that people who live in cities have a more active amygdala than people who live in the rural scene. So, I mean, lots of evidence is pointing to exactly what we're saying.
You are listening to WGXC Radio in Greene and Columbia Counties with studios in Acre, Hudson, and Catskill. This is community radio, and you are listening to the Deciding Mind radio show. We come on every month, third Sunday of the month. Okay.
We're going to go back to Bruce McEwen, speaking about the impact of stress on the brain.
So I have a question about chronic stress and the immune system and perhaps autoimmune system. Mm-hmm.
That's a very good question. The autoimmune system, we seem to be experiencing a lot of diseases that are being attributed to autoimmune responses.
Yeah, I'm my wife is a neuroimmunologist, and so she'd probably be better to answer this. But in fact, her name is Karen Bullock, and she studies the brain's immune system. And the brain does have cells, microglia, but dendritic-like cells, which are the primary sort of immune responders. And they seem, in the brain at least, to help to keep the brain's response to pathogens quiet, except under, you know, unusual circumstances like perhaps multiple sclerosis and so on.
With this chronic stress, with this high allostatic load where it goes up, doesn't really come down.
I think what is happening is that you have the circulating antibodies, and you have the immune cells that basically attack the invading agents. This is acquired immunity. You also have innate immunity, the so-called natural killer cells. The innate immunity is called into action by stressors. the acute phase response and so on. So the excess sympathetic activity will enhance the innate immune response. The levels of cortisol help to tip the balance between cellular immunity, which will attack a virus, for example, and help to clear a virus, and humoral immunity, which is what you need for certain kinds of defense. And generally speaking, a history of stress, this is the work of a guy named Sheldon Cohen at the University of Pittsburgh, or Carnegie Mellon University, tends to impair that cellular immunity so that a person who has a stress history will show more severe symptoms of a common cold or a flu. And they'll have more circulating antibodies to those coat proteins, but that doesn't really do any good for the defense. So the balance between cellular and humoral immunity is very important. The overuse of the innate immunity is another aspect of this. And then autoimmunity, of course, is the body normally selects out things that are like themselves, but under circumstances that I think we don't fully understand, that out-selection process can go awry. One of the most bizarre examples of that is the stiff man syndrome, where somebody who has a tumor of a certain kind and who has developed cellular immunity against that tumor, so the tumor is contained in the periphery, but has apparently antigens that are also in the brain that are recognized by those same immune cells, they get into the brain, which they normally may not do, and they start attacking the brain, and so the brain develops a neurological disorder. The person may not know they have cancer, but they go to a neurologist who discovers they have this problem, and then they realize the immune system has reacted against a tumor. Now, this is not really autoimmunity, but it is if it's reacting against the brain. So there are lots of bizarre cases like that, and I think autoimmunity is something that certainly I don't fully understand. I'm not sure we've really put it into the picture. But the difference between humoral and cellular immunity, the ability of chronic stress to suppress cellular immunity to then enhance the pathology of viral infections, that's pretty clear. Mm-hmm.
I was struck today by the attachment that it was a rat study, right? There's an innate attachment, and mm-hmm. even if the provider is abusive, mm-hmm. there's attachment. I was thinking it has implications, a lot of implications.
Absolutely.
But you also said that puts them at risk, but also may provide some resilience?
Well, I mean, certainly, If we look at sort of the people who somehow are able to survive early adversity, whether it's poverty or not, and do reasonably well, as opposed to people who develop some serious mental or physical health disorder, those are people who have found somebody, it might be brother, sister, aunt, uncle, grandma, teacher who provides that stability. And what I said that sort of highlights the rodent studies by an investigator named Acacia Tang have taken the Michael Meany model, the idea that maternal attachment is important, no doubt it's important, but has shown that it isn't just the amount of maternal care, but it's the consistency over time. And in addition, in a consistent maternal care environment, exposing to limited amounts of novelty that leads to better cognitive and social development. And what Acacia Tang has done is to follow these animals out until they're 12, 13 months old and have related this very systematically to the characteristics of the mother and the characteristics of the mother's care. And interestingly enough, one thing that has turned out, it gets back to our discussion of the stress response, is that the best mothers are the ones who can turn on their cortisol response from a low baseline and then presumably turn it off efficiently. And the offspring from those litters who are well adapted also show that same characteristic. So it's somehow passing on maybe good prefrontal control of the amygdala and all of that sort of stuff. But that seems to be now certainly from animal models, but certainly the primate and monkey studies, including some we didn't hear about today, all support that idea. So it's consistency. And then people, as you said, a child seeks some kind of attachment. And they may attach to a parent who is very inconsistent, and that can lead to problems later. But if they're also lucky enough, they find somebody else who provides a consistent pattern. And I think the human organism has this basic drive to do that.
To attach.
To it, to find stability.
To search
well.
For a good attachment object.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it seems to be the best explanation for why there are this ability of some people to rise above this sort of thing.
It would seem to me that I don't hear enough of it, correct me if I'm mistaken, but they would do well to study what is the biochemistry and neurology of resilience.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
There might be answers in there that we don't know.
I think so. And then, you know, animal models related to anxiety and depression, we actually look for strains or for perhaps even genetic predispositions or developmental predispositions like maternal separation or prenatal stress that make an animal more less resilient later on. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so that's the direction that a lot of the animal research is going. And, of course, in human research, the whole idea is to focus on the exception, shall we say, the people who survive, and try to understand a little more about what's going on. I mean, we know that, you know, with our middle class, I mean, I have kids and grandkids, and I see the struggles that they have, and they're fairly well off. Just to manage, you know, all of these things. Uh-huh. And you have, you know, the alcoholic parent, the job loss, economic concerns, crowded living quarters. And then you add on to that neighborhood problems for people who are lower SES. You have so many things that are impinging on them. And the more of these things, and of course it also depends on attachment and support, the greater the incidence of mental health, but also of physical health problems.
Right.
And that's what the ACE score, the Adverse Childhood Experiences score. There's actually now a sort of website for people who are interested in this that Vincent Felitti helped to start called ACEs High. It, you know, it allows communication among people who are interested in this topic. It is a problem that's increasing. I mean, as the middle class gets squeezed, as the, you know, the chaos and, you know, just our collective lives becomes greater, you're going to have more of this kind of thing. You know, there's very few people whose ACE score is zero.
Right.
And the good news from, you know, Eric and people like him is that biology is not destiny. I mean, there is the possibility of plasticity. It's going to take more energy, more effort to undo things.
So he was doing Head Start? Is that what?
Well,
he works with
Head Start. Mm-hmm. And then he and his colleagues in Oregon, there, Helen Neville and Phil Fisher is another guy's name, they are doing these very creative intervention programs that I presume are helping to build the strength of the prefrontal cortex. I mean, that's
I heard him say dampen down emotion.
Right, because that has the ability to control the amygdala, among other things. The prefrontal cortex controls emotional reactivity, impulsivity. It helps in working memory. It helps in decision making, the ability to stop one task and start something else. All of these are benefited by. Are controlled by the prefrontal cortex. And, of course, the other part, which we haven't talked about yet, is regular physical activity enhances the activity of the prefrontal cortex.
I'm aware of Paul Tuff's article and work on how
children and new book.
Succeed. Actually, we did a show that had something to do with that. I believe the issues were grit and maybe
I'm still reading it, but the whole idea, which really relates to prefrontal cortical development, is developing good self-regulatory behaviors, good attention, but also
persistence,
the ability to persist even though you don't understand, you don't feel immediately rewarded, you stick with it to try to complete the task. So it's conscientiousness.
And that can be taught. That should be
taught. And that's what he's talking about is our programs, talking about a couple of schools in the New York area and how they go about it and which things seem to
how
facilitate.
Give incentive to the kids.
To that,
to develop
exactly.
Yeah, Nora Volko has talked about allocating resources, and it would seem that hitting early childhood probably is
absolutely essential.
One of our most effective methods of
Nora Volko really gets it. Yeah. And, I mean, thank goodness there's somebody who sees the broader picture of how society determines a lot of these things through brain development. And one of the solution to substance abuse is to reduce that impulse to abuse substances by providing this better sort of self-regulation. That would really take care of it.
And a lot of people see it as entitlement, but it's actually prevention of future costs.
Absolutely, and prevention of a lot of things in terms of criminal behavior and also improvement in educational attainment, which will in turn lead to increased income, less demand on the welfare system. I mean,
but, I can imagine these sort of things are going to go into the better schools and that the schools with fewer resources, if you were to put these kind of programs,
But Tuft talks about some of the, some people in some poorer schools in Los Angeles. There's one example. I'm sure I'll talk about others. And also this pediatrician, Nadine Burke, her poverty clinic in the Bay Area that is trying to do this, the same kind of things that the people in Oregon are trying to do.
We're going to try to provide links to these.
That would be great.
Researchers
and also the National Council on the Developing Child, National Scientific. They have a wonderful website. And among other things, and you'll hear some of this afternoon, they also talk about the return on investment. That is, I mean, we're not a society that thinks more than 2 years in advance, unfortunately. But
I think it's hard for our minds to do that.
It is.
Long.
But the long
cycles.
Right. Well, the House of Representatives as well. But thinks longer and how this would benefit society. I mean, look at the plights of our prisons and how much of this could be prevented by this. How much is wasted? Yeah. Right.
Okay, thank you very much for joining
us.
Thank you.
Well, that was interesting. You know, he didn't get a chance to talk about one of the last things, one of the last group of scientists, but I'm just going to throw it out there. They actually chose to look at MRIs of children and looked at and comparing wealthy, high SES and low SES, that's socioeconomic status, and look just simply at the MRIs, the brains of 60 children. And I just thought this was interesting. The parents' education, the higher the education, the smaller the amygdala, so that would be a good thing. The amygdala.
The higher the parents' education level, the smaller the amygdala on the children.
Exactly. So, and the smaller amygdala means less emotional, efficient emotional processing. Hmm. And then the higher the parent's income was actually correlated with the larger hippocampus, which is correlated with memory. So it was they just decided to separate out SES in two different areas, parents' education and parents' income, and look at children's MRIs.
Well, those results might be for a variety of reasons, but the most interesting aspect of that is that the brain develops differently under different conditions.
Right.
And that, different parts SES of the brain are either more necessary or more emphasized or less developed depending on what you're exposed to as a child, both
right.
in conditions.
But or if you're working with certain population, you want to take these things into account and
And know what the issues are in terms of physiology.
Well, not necessarily that, but the kind of program that Eric was talking about where you help parents learn more communicate with less emotion, right? So teach them more emotional regulation skills and help teach the kids more selective attention skills.
Well, as we said in the interview, we're going to try to put a lot of those references up on our website, thedecidingmind.com. And you can go to WGXC under our show to look for old broadcasts, and as well at thedecidingmind.com, where we have a little more background information on the guests and who they're affiliated with, etc.
And I can't recommend Bruce McEwen's book more highly. It's small. It's written for the general public. It's called The End of Stress as We Know It.
It was pivotal, wasn't it, in understanding how stress affects the body? And that, when was that, 1993?
I don't think the book was then, but that's when he, you know, the book came from his early work in 93.
We have a few upcoming shows that are going to be very interesting. First of all, as many of you remember, we did an interview with Nora Volko, and we got a chance to do a much longer interview with her this time
around.
Who's
a psychiatrist, and she's head of the National Institute of Mental Health.
And she is a bundle of dynamite.
Yes.
And as you heard Bruce McEwen state, very lucky to have someone like her. She brings an enormous amount of insight into the position, and also she's a champion for those who are underserved and wants the right studies to be done to get the largest effect. So she's quite a person. Also, there was another panel that was actually quite interesting, two other panels. We'll put them up on our upcoming shows at some point. But one of the panels was concerned with whether or not we can discern facial expressions of others and how we express ourselves depending on whether we think that person is of a higher power position or higher status position, and how we respond to higher status, which goes along with a lot of what we think about decision making, that decision making is full of a lot of ambiguities, and one of them is power relations. Decisions that we make are not one off.
Right. It's all about nonverbal communication.
And also how the choices we make depending on what environment we're in. All right, well, I figured out who that was from Rona Martin's Laughing. Of course, it was Lily Tomlin as Ernestine. And I thought you might want to know how circuits are laid down, so we're going to demonstrate it right now.
I thought I saw a pudding can. I did call a pudding can.
One ringy dingy. Two ringy ding. Oh, a gracious good afternoon, Mr. Veedle. I'm Miss Tomlin, your representative from the telephone company. And you owe us a balance of $23.64. When may we expect payment? It's for three calls to Topeka, Kansas. You don't know anyone in Topeka, Kansas? Well, Mr. Veedle, that's beside the point. Now, when may we expect payment? When what freezes over? No, Mr. Veedle, you are not dealing with just anyone's fool. I am a high school graduate. Now then, Mr. Veedle? Now, Mr. Veedle, Miss Tomlin again. About this unpaid phone bill. Now, when may... Well, Mr. Veedle, I just don't see why you're kicking up such a ruckus when, according to our files, your present bank balance plus stock, security, and other holdings amount to exactly 300 and... What? Privileged information. Oh, Mr. Veedle, that's so cute. No, Mr. Veedle, you're dealing with the telephone company. For instance, now, as I look through your income tax return for 1965, Mr. Veedle? Mr. Veedle, it's me again. We seem to be a bit disconnected. Now, Mr. Veedle, I want you to understand something. We are not subject to city, state, or federal regulations. We are omnipotent. Omnipotent. That's potent with an omni in front of it. Now then, Mr. Veedle, when may we expect payment? Oh, Mr. Veedle, I'm afraid we're going to have to discontinue your outgoing service. And if we do not receive payment within 10 days, we will send a large, burly serviceman to your home to rip it out of the wall. I'd advise you to lock up the liquor. He's a mean drunk. Now, Well, then, Mr. Beetle, wouldn't you really rather pay than lose your service and possibly the use of one eye? Mr. Beetle?
I thought I saw a pretty thing.